This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, everybody. A little housekeeping to start. We're working on an episode about vanity plates right now. You know, the specialized license plates that spell out IMAQT or whatever. We are looking for your vanity plate stories. What is the best vanity plate you have ever seen? What is the worst vanity plate? Tell us all about it. 347-464-9626. This week, we have a question from Nikki, and it's about a subject that many of you have probably wondered slash had nightmares about.
You know, when you're driving through a tunnel and you know the tunnel goes under a body of water, how do they get that tunnel under there?
Hey, Nikki, it's Flora. I'm calling to tell you how they get that tunnel under there.
That is the best news I've heard all day.
Nikki, how much do you think about tunnels? Like a few hours a day or?
I would say maybe a couple minutes a day.
Does this question come from fear? Like, do you ever think about the millions of pounds of pressure pushing down on that thin wall above you and how all it would take is just a single crack to flood the tunnel and create a dark, watery tomb from which you could never escape? Is that it?
I definitely try not to, but I feel like I saw a Bruce Willis movie once where he was in that exact situation.
What's your theory for how people build underwater tunnels?
The theory that people tell me most often is that they dam it off. Like when Moses parts the Red Sea and you can see all the wildlife.
Behold his mighty hand!
Do they just do that and then build it?
God opens the sea with the blast of his nostrils.
Now, as it turns out, tunnels are not formed by God blasting his holy nostrils.
We don't need God-like intervention to build our tunnels.
What you need are tunnel engineers like Gary Brierley.
The name of my business is Dr. Mole, M-O-L-E, Inc.
Do you go by Dr. Mole?
Well, yeah, at the conferences and stuff, they introduce me as Dr. Mole. I usually tell people that I'm not a dermatologist.
Let me just tell you a little bit more about Dr. Mole.
Okay.
He's a tunnel engineer. He's worked on hundreds of them. Like when a city or municipality is making a tunnel, they'll ask him for advice on how to construct it. He's also kind of a tunnel booster.
Most people who live in urban areas have no idea how much they depend on tunnels.
The word tunnel came up 238 times in our interview. Okay, anyway, let's get to your question. So Moses doesn't build our underwater tunnels. Do you have an alternate theory for how they're made?
My alternative theory is that they construct most of, if not all of the tunnel, and then just kind of drop it in the water.
How do most people respond to your tunnel theory?
I think it's kind of stupid.
Nikki, you are right.
Really?
There's two ways to make a tunnel that goes underneath water. One is with what they call a submerged tube.
A submerged tube, a sunken tunnel. Here's how you do it.
So they dig a deep trench across the body of water, and then they have these huge steel segments that have been built in a shipyards that are the shape of the tunnel.
Like imagine a tunnel sliced into pieces, like huge pieces of tube.
Yeah, it's like a tube. It's like a gigantic tube. You know, these are big enough for highway tunnels and subway tunnels, massive structures, and they're floated into place, and then they're lowered down into the trench.
They just drop them in?
They just drop them in.
And then they do this one after the other so that they have a tunnel from one side of the water to the other.
And before they pump out the water from this tunnel, they do one important thing.
Then they have to pile rock and they put soil on top of it.
So they bury the tunnel alive underwater, basically?
Yes, and they do this to protect the tunnel so it is not in direct contact with the water, and for another reason.
To make sure that it doesn't float, because when they pump it out, it wants to float.
Is it just from air bubbles that it wants to float back up?
Yes.
How wild is that?
That's absolutely bananas. Can you imagine if you were driving a barge over it and a tunnel full of cars just floated up to the surface?
Nobody who would design one of these things would make a mistake like that. That would be a disaster.
Okay, so that's one way to make a tunnel underwater, but this submerged tube method has environmental costs because you have to, like, dig up the bottom and it interferes with shipping. So there's another way, too.
Most tunnels are made with these large tunnel boring machines. It's a huge cylinder of steel. It's just like a big tomato can, okay?
Okay. If you want to know how big a tomato can we're talking about, Dr. Moll mentioned Bertha, a boring machine used in Seattle.
This was an enormous piece of equipment, phenomenally powerful, and it was 60 feet in diameter. So that's as big as a six-story building, okay?
A tomato can of that size would hold roughly 123 million tomatoes.
And they just push it through the water?
No. So this giant tomato can bores through the ground underneath the seafloor.
Wow.
And I really want you to know what this looks like. So, Nikki, I'm going to send you a video.
All right. Sorry. One second.
And if you're listening at home and you want to watch along, you can go to elt.show/terrifying machine.
Meters long and weighs 1,000 tons.
It's like a tomato can on its side, and the head of the can has spinning blades on it.
It has a rotating cutter head at the front and a series of trailers.
So it's the rotating head that excavates the soil or the rock, and then it's the jacks that push it forward.
I think my first question is, where is it putting all of the dirt and soil and stuff that it's sending through its horrible blade phase?
Well, dirt is accumulated either on a conveyor or in an auger, and then it's brought through the machine.
And then it's conveyed out of the tunnel. You could just imagine it like as a massive worm moving below the earth and eating and immediately defecating everything in its path.
And then what you do is you build the lining inside the machine.
Stopped and the ring building phase starts.
So this tunnel boring machine isn't just chewing through rock, it's creating the lining of the tunnel. It's placing these giant concrete rings that hold up the walls of the tunnel.
The tunnel is completely encased in either steel or concrete. So the possibility of anything collapsing or caving into the tunnel under those circumstances is almost zero.
When you're looking at it, that ring of concrete that it's putting down really doesn't look that thick, but that's also probably that latent fear that I'll die in the dirt and rock and water.
Yes, the buried alive in a tunnel fear apparently is not something that we have to worry about.
Tunnels are very safe. They're very stable. If you go to Rome and you stand by those fountains in Rome, those fountains are being supplied by tunnels that were built 2,000 years ago.
And on that note, Dr. Moll has a message just for you.
If Nikki ever feels like she wants to be safe from something, she really ought to go in a tunnel. They survive earthquakes extremely well.
Okay, so if I ever find myself in a twister scenario or really any doomsday movie scenario, go to a tunnel.
Yes, and only ELT listeners will be in that tunnel because it's the most counterintuitive place to go in a doomsday scenario.
Just us and the giant tomato can.
ELT Apocalypse Meetup. Who's bringing the rations? After the break, we're moving back to dry land to help our coworker with a slippery situation.
Hello, ELT. This is Erin. Erin from Gimlet. I do have a question that I would love to be addressed. Why is ice slippery? All right. Is this a good question? I don't know. Maybe I'll be embarrassed tomorrow in the office, but I'm curious.
Hey, Flora.
Get on in here. How does the executive assistant to the co-founders of Gimlet find herself calling the ELT helpline?
Well, it was a long-time listener, first-time caller situation, I have to say. And when I had this conundrum, I was like, I know who to call.
You didn't have like a Newton's apple
no.
type of situation where you fell.
I mean, I have slipped on ice many a time. This isn't foreign. I wasn't extrapolating. I've lived it.
This is the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
I do not want you to be embarrassed of this question.
Great.
And I don't mean that in a, like, there's no such thing as a stupid question kind of way, because they're for sure stupid questions.
But not this one.
This is not one of them.
Oh, not at all. It's not an embarrassing question because, surprisingly enough, even though intuitively everybody knows that ice is slippery, the reasons of why has been in debate forever. Forever.
Two forevers. That is how long people have been debating why ice is slippery. And that guy would know. His name is Mikhail Salmeron.
And I'm a scientist. I'm a physicist by background.
He studied water for a long time. And his...
What does that mean?
Water has always been a topic that has fascinated me. How are the molecules arranged? You know, how do they move?
His whole jam is surfaces.
Interfaces, we call it.
And slipperiness is all about the interface. Because at ice's surface, you get this super thin layer of water. And it's that water on top of the ice that's key.
You need liquid water. And this water layer makes it slippery.
And water is slippery because as a liquid, it breaks apart more easily than a solid. So it doesn't hold you back as you slide across it. And it also fills in all of the teeny tiny little microscopic holes and cracks, smoothing out the surface of the ice so your shoe doesn't catch.
But if the ice is frozen and if the ice is in an atmosphere that is all below freezing temperature, why doesn't that last bit of water freeze?
That is the mystery. Where does the water come from? Scientists have been debating that question since the 1800s.
I don't know if you've ever heard of the name Lord Kelvin.
Oh, sure. Like, Kelvin is the temperature.
Yeah, famous scientist dude from the UK. He and his brother had a theory that the thin layer of water on top of ice is created by the pressure of you standing on the ice.
You can melt the water by pressing hard.
Why does that happen, Flora? Why does pressure melt ice?
I feel like you're mocking me, Aaron, but here is why. It has to do with the structure of ice.
Water molecule, as you know, is a group of three atoms.
Sure, H2O, yeah.
Those atoms make up a water molecule, and when the temperature is below freezing, those water molecules arrange in a very particular way.
They're forced to take positions and orientations that allow them to grow like a crystal.
So ice is like a castle made of crystals. And what do you think happens when you stomp on that castle?
It shatters?
Yes. When you apply pressure, the crystal is destroyed.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
The architecture of those bonds change.
Got it.
The molecules move closer together.
And then they become water.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. So that is what Lord Kelvin said. That's why we can skate and ski.
You can skate because your skate creates pressure that creates this water that makes you slip. And that was the accepted gospel.
I still remember when I was a kid in school, you know, and that was in my physics book.
That ice is never slippery until you step on it? That, no. Say that out loud. Like, oh, nope. That's like, do you remember in like middle school, people told you that blood was blue because your veins were blue and that's not real? So this feels like, I feel it's like a little thin. It's like not a, you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And you're not alone in your skepticism.
Another scientist, again from the United Kingdom, it was Michael Faraday. I don't know if you heard about his name, Michael Faraday.
He sounds like a chemist.
Think more of magnets, electricity going through wires. That's more what Michael Faraday did. Nothing to do with ice, as you can see. But he's a scientist, and like many scientists, curious. So he heard the explanations of Lord Kelvin, and it didn't make sense to him.
So Faraday's thought is you don't necessarily need pressure to create that water layer on the surface of ice.
So it must be some other explanation.
And Faraday's explanation is that ice just naturally has a liquid layer on top of it. Like, ice is your sweaty friend who's sweaty even when it's cold.
Yeah, okay. You don't need to call that person out because, like, maybe someone in this room is the sweaty friend. Okay, Flora? But why?
Right. Why is ice naturally sweaty? Okay, think about the crystal castle again and imagine the penthouse of that castle. That is the surface of ice.
The ones at the surface, the atoms and molecules at the surface, they are missing the neighbors above it.
And because they don't have neighbors above, those atoms at the surface of ice are going to naturally move and shake more than their neighbors.
They're freer, simply are freer. There is no mystery here, right? There is no mystery.
So those penthouse atoms, they jiggle more. They break the bonds of the crystal castle.
And then you've got to be water. Yeah, okay. So those little guys that are on the end, they're not held back by groupthink. They're out on their own. And they're like, you know what would be better here? To be water.
Yeah. And Faraday had a really inspiring term for this. He called it pre-melt.
Pre-melt. So he is right and Kelvin is wrong?
No, they're both like a third right because they both identify ingredients that are important for slipperiness. But there's one more ingredient that gets added to the recipe in the 1930s.
There is friction. You know, when you rub your hands, friction warms your hands, right? Then same thing, the skis or the shoes rubbing against the ice, melt the ice because of the friction heat.
And those are the three ingredients for slipperiness: friction, pre-melt, and pressure. But exactly how they work together in a particular moment to make you slide across the ice, that still isn't totally understood. So people are still doing experiments today, people like Mikhail Salmeron, to try to figure out how these ingredients work together to create slipperiness.
We know more or less, but the details of how and why slippery are still controversial.
You asked a question that hit on a fundamental mystery of everyday life.
You're welcome.
And if you have a question about a fundamental mystery of everyday life, give us a ring, 347-464-9626. And don't forget, if you've seen a great vanity plate or a terrible vanity plate, give us a ring at the same number, 347-464-9626.
Every Little Thing was produced by Aaron Reese and Annette Heist, with Flora Lichtman, Catherine Wells, Phoebe Flanagan, and Sakia Gibbons. ELT got help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Ian Chillug is our consulting editor. Scoring by Bobby Lord and Dara Hirsch. Dara Hirsch mixed this episode. Goodbye.